Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Welcome to this week's Democracy Sausage, coming to you from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kenny. Have you ever attended one of those picnics where the wine laid on is seriously good and the food is, well, let's say, not your average barbecue fare? That's how I feel right now, because my guests this week are gourmet analysts of the contemporary American condition, and they're both Australians. Dr. Anne Summers is a peerless author, journalist, columnist, and originator of magazines who lives in New York. Her most recent book, Unfettered and Alive, is a compelling memoir which tells not merely her own story, but also maps the major social and political developments in Australia since the 1970s. And Jonathan Swan is a gun political correspondent for Axios in Washington, D.C., where, among other things, he produces the influential Sneak Peek newsletter. Like Anne and myself, he's also a former press gallery journalist in Australia, having worked with me at the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Mark.
Good to be with you.
And let's start with you. Is life coming back to some kind of normal in New York City, where the coronavirus has wreaked so much death and economic destruction?
No, not at all. I mean, New York still hasn't complied with the benchmarks that need to be met before the economy is allowed to reopen. The state set, I think it's 8 benchmarks, all to do with hospital capacity and number of tests and tracer capacity and so on. And New York is down on 2 of them, the most important one being contact tracers. We're 2,500 short of the number we need to have, and it's not expected that we'll have those numbers, and also the excess hospital capacity, which is required before probably the first, or more likely the second week of June. So it's only at that point that the New York City economy can start to reopen, and that will be in a fairly minor way with construction and things like that. So what's happening at the moment is that people are kind of venturing out into the streets a bit more, particularly as the weather's getting very nice, and it's not as it's a much bigger hardship to be cooped up in your apartment when the sun's shining and it's 80 degrees outside. And I'd say the biggest issue that we're facing at the moment, certainly where I live, is the kind of the mask war. And it's not like in some states in this country, which where it's become a cultural war, and you see people screaming at people to take their masks off and calling them, liberal trash and liberal scum and all this sort of thing. Here, it just seems to be more an act of kind of ignorance or even arrogance on the part of a lot of particularly young people who just don't want to wear the masks, even though it is mandated here that we should wear them.
It's extraordinary, this whole, as you say, this culture war element of all of this and the mask becoming a kind of a marker for that, or a divisive marker for that that argument. It's really amazing.
Ridiculous.
Well, particularly when we think about it, like compare it to Australia, where there's been a sense of this, crisis unifying things, minimizing divisions, creating a greater sense of as they say, we're all in this together. Now, there are some ways in which that's not the case, of course. None of this is absolute or perfect. But It's really extraordinary. Just sticking with New York for a moment, though, what's really interesting is just how uneven the spread of cases and of deaths has been in the US. I mean, New York State, for example, on a per capita basis, I read has 150 times greater death toll than, say, the state of Montana. And there are very many more deaths sort of clustered on the northeast side of the country. What's the explanation for that, or the understanding of it?
Well, I mean, in the case of New York City, I mean, our mayor wanted to act and close down the city before the governor wanted. There was a bit of toing and froing between those two, who have a traditional long-standing rivalry. So we were a bit slow just to shut down. I mean, we did it ahead of some other states, but California got in first, and California, I think, and Washington State and Oregon all closed down a week earlier. If we'd closed down then, we would have averted a lot of this. But at the same time, I mean, you have to remember that the sheer density of population in a place like New York City means that once the virus has taken off, it moves very quickly. The subway system is old and dirty and disgusting, and it takes 6 million people a day ride it, so that's a major factor for transmission, and just the sheer density of the workplaces, of restaurants, of bars, of all of the places where people congregate. So I think the governor and Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio have done a good job since then, but they had a huge mountain of infections to deal with. The other thing I'd say about New York and the uneven impact of the way in which the disease has hit the population of this city is that, the rich people all basically left town. There's 400,000 people left the city, and they tended to be from the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, and some of them, I'm sorry to say, from where I live in Dumbo, which is in Brooklyn in New York. So anyone who had a country house in the Hamptons or upstate or Florida or Arizona or wherever got out of Dodge, and so they have been largely spared. And so this disease has really impacted on people who couldn't escape, and also people who were emergency or essential workers who had no choice but to go to work, and often to go to work on the subway where they were likely to become infected. So it's been a really very grim diagnosis of what the mechanics of this city are, to see how the rich escape tragedy and how the poor were stuck with it.
Yes, I'd like to come to a bit later to some of those sort of differential effects of both the virus, but particularly the response to it and what it's exposed as we've seen the economy shut down. As we record this, the US has just passed that grim milestone, as it's known, 100,000 deaths, 100,047 deaths right at this point as we're making this recording. And they're mostly clustered in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Boston, Michigan, Pennsylvania. And New York State has 29,000 of those, so not far off a third of those. What about the capital, Jonathan Swan? What about Washington, D.C.? What's the situation there?
So I think there've been something in the order of 500 deaths in Washington, D.C. The surrounding area in Northern Virginia, Maryland, has been pretty bad, and it's been quite bad in the last month. But nothing on the scale, obviously, of New York City or even New Jersey, Michigan, some of these other states. I'm just talking specifically about Washington, D.C. But we're starting to ease restrictions. I think Friday at midnight Thursday, they're going to start to ease some of the restrictions, because they've been on a decent trajectory in terms of new cases, and the testing has been, I won't say promising, but heading in the right direction. So it hasn't been nearly as bad as New York.
And it was pretty clear from the beginning of this that Donald Trump wasn't inclined to sort of square up to this pandemic threat in the way that other leaders were shaping to do and have done, even in Australia, for example. And I guess that was obvious because, beyond his well-known misogyny and his well-known, personal invective against individuals, one of the most defining features of his presidency has been this sort of steadfast refusal to learn and grow on the job. Nothing about the way the Trump administration ran suggested that it was up to really meeting this challenge head on. Would you agree with that, Anne?
Oh, where do we start with Donald Trump? Yes, I would agree with that. I guess we've just watched. It's obviously different for Jonathan sitting there, close to the scene. But there's just sitting someone sitting in New York City watching. I mean, I used to watch his daily press briefings for a while, and in the end, I just had to stop. I just couldn't bear these sort of Castro-like rants. Some of them went for 2 hours long. And the non-stop aggrandizement, the lies, the pushing of his mates, the boosting of various businesses, the promoting of shonky drugs or inappropriate drugs, and it's just the whole circus of what has transpired in the last 2 months has been horrifying, because it's life threatening. It's actually has already led to a spike in deaths that ought never to have happened. I think this has actually been quantified as to, 35,000 or 65,000 or whatever calculation you want to look at, that deaths that were preventable have happened because of the leader of this country failed to act, and in fact has been in denial, as he's still in denial. And he's saying, even today, I think, or certainly yesterday, that 100,000 deaths is not a problem, because it should have, we could have had 2 million deaths, and so 100,000 is nothing. We should be grateful. I find him contemptuous, but I also find him terrifying.
Jonathan?
There were two reasons initially why he was unwilling to listen to his advisors. Number one was he has this obsession with the stock market. It's probably the singular. I've been covering him since 2015, and I remember covering him on the campaign and going to rallies. And when you talk to Trump in that period, he was obsessed with the polls, right? And it was when he was polling particularly well. He was in the primary. It was something he could boast. He always needs a metric with which he can say, this is how good I am. This is the number that stipulates exactly how amazing I am. And when the polls stopped being good, he turned to the stock market, and the Dow became his poll, and he was obsessed with it. And it colored so much of his thinking. It colored the way he thought about trade deals. It colored the way he thought about anything. And the best way to think about Trump is, and it's not an original observation, but it really is how he operates. He's a day trader. He doesn't think in the long term. He thinks about what he needs to do to get through the next minute, hour, news cycle. What can I do and say right now to get instant gratification? And, of course, when people started to talk about this virus in late January, it was something that only in his mind posed one thing, which was, this could really screw up my beautiful economy and my beautiful stock market if people get overly spooked about it. He genuinely didn't think it was going to come here. And in his mind, putting in some travel restrictions was going to sort of hermetically seal off America. There was a period where he didn't want to let people in off one of these cruise ships because it would add to the numbers of people that were infected. And so for the longest period of time, mostly through February and early March, that was the mindset. What can we do? And then you had advisors going out saying, we've got this thing contained, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was this moment in probably around March 11th when it dawned on him that this was out of his control, that this was not something that he could tweet away. This was not something that he could, describe as fake news or use his usual toolbox. And that's been the greatest frustration for him because, frankly, there's been so many times in this presidency where commentators have said, this is the mortal blow, or this will undo him, whether it be the threat of his financial records coming out with Deutsche Bank or the Mueller investigation and Russia, or this is the final shoe to drop. And he's actually constitutionally pretty well set up to manage that kind of assault. But when it's something where you actually have to rely on the government, which to a large extent he's gutted, experts, bureaucrats, the scientific community, calm, measured, consistent public communication, this is not what Donald Trump does. So right now, for example, you have this situation where he has completely moved on from the public health messaging, explicitly so. He doesn't want to be out there talking about statistics or, you know, the need for social distancing. He is trying now to position himself as, in this election, the candidate who's going to reopen your economy, who's going to bring back the glory days of the economy. You know, he's out there not wearing a mask. He loves the visual contrast of him being mask-free and Joe Biden wearing a mask. And that's what he's setting up for the fall. He's trying to defy the reality of the current polling, which is that people are still very concerned about this virus. They're worried about going back out to their normal lives. And he is trying to kind of will it to be that people will kind of end up where he's at.
It's a really a great description, I think, that idea of him as a day trader and seeing it in those very sort of tactical terms all the time. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think it's all his performance throughout this is also a function of that mindset going in? That is, once he'd conceded the ability to take the initiative, once he'd let this thing get out of control through his own inaction and sort of denial of it, he was locked onto that path. And we know politicians, not just Trump, most politicians we know aren't big on admitting they're wrong, admitting they've made a wrong step. So he's kind of been locked into this this path of trying to, negotiate it, mediate it in other ways, blaming it on China and failures of other individuals and politicization and all these sorts of things.
The frustrating part of it as a reporter is some of his critiques have actually a lot of basis to them. So the China critique, I mean, I interviewed the Chinese ambassador to the US for our HBO show recently. I mean, they have a lot to answer for, but Trump, of course, takes it to this other level. And you have, you know, members of his administration getting out over their skis with the statements they're making, the level of certainty that they were applying to this theory that the virus came out of a lab in Wuhan. So they always take it further. But look, Trump was never going to handle this any way other than what he has. like it was never going to be any other way. He was never going to be sticking to a consistent message or urging caution, urging social distancing, urging masks. The mask thing is really interesting. I mean, Trump has very, and this is not, again, it's not my opinion. This is described to me by people who are in there with him, you know, helping him set up for some of his interviews and his shots. He has very particular ideas about what a president should look like. And he used to go on and on about how he would never be like Jimmy Carter and be photographed carrying his own luggage as a president. That was something he was sort of this idea of this president as, you know, lowered, as a lowered figure, as sort of one of the ordinary folks. He likes to kind of be elevated and set apart. And he thinks, one thing he thinks obsessively about is the pageantry and stagecraft of the presidency. And so people are saying, oh, the mask thing, he's doing it, for, you know, the polling and tactics. It's complete nonsense. I know from my own reporting that he was instinctively against the idea of himself wearing masks from the outset. And it was pure vanity and, you know, his own conception of the image of the presidency. So people try and overlay way too many theories of Trump and, you know, tactics and strategy. And mostly it's just a guy operating on pure instinct, minute to minute, hour to hour, doing whatever he wants with pure abandon, knowing that he has an entire political party besides one lonely senator, Mitt Romney, completely under his thumb. He acts with entire knowledge, safe in the knowledge that no one can touch him in his own party, and that defines everything he does.
Do you have a thought on that, Anne?
Well, one of the things that I find extraordinary and a question I have not been able to answer since I've been living in this country and since Trump has been president is how he has been able to capture the Republican Party in the way that Jonathan has described, and why it is that even when it increasingly looks against the self-interest, i.e. the survival of certain senators and possibly the administration, they continue to cover for him, defend him on issues and on policies that are, you know, absurd often. And it's just something I simply do not understand, how he's been able to achieve that, how nobody tries to stop him.
Well, can I offer a few thoughts?
Sure.
Yeah. So when you talk to these Republican senators who really don't like Trump, many of them, on a personal level, his character, they do not think so, you know, I shouldn't say many of them. There's at least a dozen that I can think of off the top of my head in the Republican Senate that I have talked to in a confidential capacity who've expressed that view to me. Here's the problem. In terms of their political survival, they're not going to persuade. There's very few persuadable voters at this point. It's really just mobilizing your base, mobilizing your voters. And the polls are blatantly clear. Republican voters really like Trump. They overwhelmingly like Trump. They like Trump more than Republican voters liked George Bush after 9/11 in some polls. And when you go to, I mean, I've been to so many Trump rallies, I don't even know where to begin, but it is like, I don't know if you've been to one, but it's like the only thing to describe it to is almost a religious event. The devotion and the intensity of his support is like nothing I've ever seen in politics. These people just, they ride or die for Trump. And it's a combination of a religious event, sort of mega church type of vibe, combined with a kind of almost like a rock concert. They know all the lyrics. All he needs to do is say Hillary Clinton and they'll start spontaneously chanting "Lock her up." The intensity and the bonding of his supporters. And, you know, it was interesting. I was talking to someone who runs one of the big outside groups for Republican Party. I shouldn't say runs, a senior person at one of these outside groups. And they were talking to some activists in one of the key states. And it was really interesting. So this is North Carolina. Tom Tillis is vulnerable there in the Senate. And some of these Republican activists were basically saying he hasn't been sufficiently loyal to Trump. I mean, this is a guy who has really sucked up to Trump almost unendingly in his time in the Senate. But this activist had remembered a critical thing that he said about Trump in an opinion piece 18 months ago about the president, you know, declaring a national emergency and whatever. This is how closely the base is following it, and how this is the kind of feedback when these senators go home. It's not, oh, why can't you be more, you know, of a check and balance against the president? What they're hearing consistently is, why did you not stand with Trump, you know, when he said that Joe Scarborough, the cable news host, murdered, you know, the person in his office, this conspiracy theory? You know, that's the message they'll get back home. Where were you when Trump was being persecuted over this? And so you respond to the pressures from your own constituents. I mean, it's really...
But Jonathan, at the same time, yeah. I mean, the polling overall suggests that this is not working. It's not working for a majority of people.
But if you just look
at
what I'm saying is for these Republicans, they're responding to their own voters. I mean,
I understand that. But I mean, aren't they on a suicide mission?
Well, they're on a suicide mission if they cross him. Because in their minds, they're never going to win over the Democrats, the Democratic voters and the independents and the swing voters. They might win a few independent swing voters in the middle, but they're going to lose their base. So, like, I'll give you an example. Susan Collins, right? She's running in Maine, okay? One of the more vulnerable senators. She tries to walk this line. She sometimes criticizes Trump, but when it really matters on the big votes, like confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, she sticks with Trump, because she knows if she really crosses him in a big and public way, they're not going to turn up, the base isn't going to turn up and vote for her, and there just simply aren't enough swing independent voters to make up for the base not showing up. So they're making these awful political calculations.
This is really fascinating. So it's almost like the strength of his position, the extremeness or extremity of his political persona is such that even staying silent is seen as not being, as making a decision in itself, not being sufficiently muscular in your support if you're in the GOP. And so that leaves you vulnerable to those sorts of criticisms. And as you say, the calculation you have to make if you're up for election is, will my base stick with me? Because I'm not going to get our president is so controversial that I'm not going to get swing voters and Democrats who might be thinking, oh, look, you know, my local representative is actually pretty moderate, therefore I'm going to support him or her. That just doesn't happen because Trump has so successfully polarized the electorate and turned the GOP almost into a sort of a cult, and that's how the base is operating.
It was already very polarized, but Trump has just – again, it's hard to explain the intensity without just seeing it yourself. I really have never seen anything like it. It's this just utter devotion to him, and an alertness, an absolute alertness to any sign of disloyalty or flirtation with the other side.
Let's take a quick break there and come back in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, Ann Summers, why do you think Trump has refused in this crisis? I mean, we've talked a bit about the approach he's taken to it, the sort of denial that he took to it in the beginning, and he's stuck to that. But looking at the issue of grief itself at the death toll, is it his culpability that is at play here in this? What is the reason, as you understand it, that Donald Trump hasn't risen to the place that presidents generally go at times of national mourning and crisis? People talk about Barack Obama singing Amazing Grace after the Charleston shootings. They talk about George W. Bush at Ground Zero speaking to first responders through a loudhailer. Trump, on the other hand, makes very little, very, very infrequent references to the death toll has done almost nothing in that space. Is it simply his culpability, or is he just only about the positive?
Well, I think, as Jonathan has explained, I mean, he's not that type of president. I mean, he's not a president. He's a cult leader. He's a demagogue. He's a, there's all the words that one could summons up to describe the kind of leader that we don't normally associate, or we've never had to associate in the past with the presidency of the United States. And I think the question, we're 5 months out from the election. The question going forward is, are enough Americans living in the right places, in the right states, going to endorse this type of presidency, or is he going to be chucked out? I mean, that's the only question in the United States at the moment, as far as I'm concerned. And, I guess, with the polls, there's all sorts of polls that you can look at. There's electoral college pathway maps that you can look at that all show the Democrats having a likely narrow win, or a likely big win. But whether or not that is actually going to happen, you know, we don't know. We just simply don't know what's going to happen, as far as I can tell, but until the votes come in. If it's a fair election, if there's no interference, if there's people are allowed to vote, if we don't have a situation as we saw in Wisconsin recently, then I think Trump has got a very tough battle ahead of him, and I certainly hope that he loses. But if we know that he's not going to be sanguine about accepting results he doesn't like, we know that he's a dirty fighter, and we know he has a lot of help from all sorts of nefarious sources, including likely some foreign government ones. So I don't know what Jonathan thinks about this, but at the moment I'd say it's going to be a very, very tough few months.
What do you think about it, Jonathan? Do you think that he can't do the mourner-in-chief thing because that legitimizes the criticism about his government's failure, or is it just that he doesn't have empathy?
It's mostly because if he the extent to which he dwells on, you know, if he was to do an event tomorrow where he stood up and, you know, read out the names of a number of people who died and really drew a line under this, it would be an acknowledgement of failure. And he's not going to do that. But as for the election, look, it's people often talk about the national polls. I mean, Biden's 10 points ahead in the national polls. It is still quite conceivable that Biden does even better than Hillary Clinton did in terms of the national vote and beats Trump by, who knows, 2 million, 3 million votes overall. It's still possible that he loses the Electoral College. And it's really, I mean, the only states that I'm really paying attention to are Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona.
Is that one of the reasons he's going so hard after this guy he refers to as Psycho Joe Scarborough? He's from Florida, is he not?
No, that's just a pure petty grievance with a cable news host. There's absolutely no strategic thought or value in that.
But said cable news host is a former GOP congressman, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, but he's become, you know, one of Trump's biggest critics on TV. I mean, he calls Trump mentally ill almost every day. I mean, so it's not really he's not really a Republican. And I think he even left the Republican Party, renounced his membership. So that's just a bit of a sideshow. But he's looking very weak in Michigan right now, and his team do not feel particularly good about Michigan. Arizona is actually quite problematic for them. It's very, very tight in Arizona, and obviously there's a pretty solid Hispanic vote there. So Democrats are running really hard at Arizona. But in terms of the things that the Trump campaign's worried about, it's not even close. The number one thing they're concerned about, and there's nothing even close, is his weakness among seniors. He has significant
Florida.
In Florida, but also nationally, he has significant slippage among seniors, and Joe Biden is significantly outperforming Hillary Clinton among elderly Americans. And that is a huge problem because that is Trump's base. And that's what they're worried about. And what they're worried about is, look, the Trump campaign itself mechanically is very good. It's a very strong campaign. It's a far better campaign than the Biden campaign. If you're just talking about online campaigning, online fundraising, the mechanics of, you know, digital campaigning, modern campaigning, you'd expect that. They've got a four-year head start. But it's a really, really strong campaign. But the thing that they're worried about is that it might not matter. Biden won Super Tuesday, cleaned up without having an operation in any of these states. It was just pure media momentum and people coming out and saying, you know what, he's all right. He's better than Bernie. Let's turn up and vote for him. A really strong African-American vote, really strong support among seniors, among moderates. And the concern I'm hearing a lot from people in Trump's orbit now is that that, yeah, okay, we might have a tactical advantage or a mechanical advantage on the campaign side, but it might not end up mattering because there might be something deeper, more fundamental that's a problem, and that's what the senior thing is. That's the concern there. They can't put their finger on it, why it is that he's had this slippage in this age group.
It sets up a really fascinating contest in terms of rewriting the normal political rules, because what candidates in democratic elections worry about always is you know, the risk factor, the possibility of a mistake, of doing something wrong, of going too far with a particular piece of rhetoric or allegation. But this doesn't seem to be in the risk equation about Trump. He does that as a matter of standard practice. And as we were discussing before, his base just seems to get more deeply committed to him as a result of that. The more partisan he is, the more reason they feel that they need to strongly, you know, that is, the more he's resented and hated by the center and the left, then the more he's loved by the right, it almost feels like. So,
except Mark, you've got to remember that there, his base is peeling off. You know, Jonathan's mentioned the seniors. I mean, the seniors is interestingly a very big gender gap amongst the seniors. I mean, many more women aged over 65 have gone off Trump than men. So the net effect, I think, is minus 10 amongst seniors, but amongst women, it's minus 22. There are similar things that have happened with Republican college-educated white women, and you're even seeing it currently amongst evangelicals and some Catholics, who all were very, very strong parts of Trump's base, who are now, for various reasons, including their concern about the way in which the coronavirus is being handled in this country, are peeling off. And so I'm not saying the base is disappearing, but it's eroding in certain key sectors that are once would have been critical to his re-election.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting point. Has he actually grown the base? Because obviously the result in 2016 was a surprise to pretty well everyone, even the Trump campaign, indeed. So it's one of those kind of, depends how you want to put it, but it was a kind of an accident in a sense. No one knew the votes were going to fall in such a way that they would lead to the college outcome that we got. This time around, does Trump have a bigger slice of the electorate than he used to have, or just a more committed slice version of what he had in 2016?
I think it's sort of the wrong question. What the campaign is doing is it's looking at these states, these very small number of states, and they're trying to locate people who would be supportive of Donald Trump and make sure that they turn out in November. They are systematically pouring through the voter rolls in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, Iowa, etc. And they are just finding people who are Trump curious or Trump supportive and making sure they turn out. And so when you say, has he grown the base? Yeah, he probably has, to the extent that they've made incremental gains of voters. They've located, found, built an online relationship and maybe a verbal phone relationship with voters. And they are going to use all of their resources to make sure they show up in November. Has he grown a broader constituency across the country and won over, you know, independent stuff? Heck no. Of course he hasn't. But again, it's the wrong question.
But has he animated his opposition at an even greater rate than he's animated people to support him?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, the only test case we've had of that is that at a decent enough scale is the midterm elections in 2018, and he wasn't on the ballot. And that test case was very bad for Republicans. They lost the House, right? So you could pick that and say, there you go, Democrats are more fired up than Republicans are in favor of Trump. I'm skeptical of that because Trump wasn't on the ballot. And, you know, incumbent presidents usually do pretty badly in midterm elections. So we'll find out. I don't think we know the answer to that question. And I'll just tell you that the Biden campaign are not complacent about this at all. They know how motivated Trump's base is, and they know how there is this possibility as an incumbent president with all the advantages that he has to pull it off again, even though the polls right now would have you believe that Biden would take this out.
Well, speaking of Biden, has he kind of gone missing through this corona affair? I mean, he's definitely not had the kind of profile that the president has, which you would expect, but he's pretty much stayed under wraps or under a mask, as Trump would like to say. What do you think, Anne?
Well, yes, he's been in his basement in Delaware and popping up occasionally, but I don't really think it matters. I mean, it's not affecting his polling. It's not affecting his ratings amongst the people he needs. The question I think the Democrats have got to address is what kind of convention they're going to have. I mean, they're talking about a largely virtual convention, not the conventional big crowds and bells and whistles, which is what Trump's still trying to have, apparently. Their question will be what happens to the campaign after the convention and in the final couple of months before polling day. And, you know, I just don't know the answer to that. But it may not matter, because if the people who don't are put off by Trump, they're going to vote against him, and it doesn't really matter what Biden does.
Let's talk about federal-state relations. In Australia, this COVID crisis has ushered in a new era of cooperation. We've seen the National Cabinet operating. We've seen personal relationships forged between the Prime Minister and some of the premiers, even across the political divide. And we're seeing talk of that National Cabinet rolling forward past the crisis in the recovery phase. There's talk about industrial relations reform, almost, sort of harking back to the accord with some of the consensual mechanisms and so forth. We'll see how much of this actually materializes, of course. It's very early days. But it's been such a dramatically different atmosphere in the US. Is this simply down to Trump, or is it simply down to the fact that there's an election looming, or is there some other reason why the federal government just can't operate with the states in the way that the crisis demands?
A lot of it is it's just welcome to America. You know, like it really is a country that is this way by design. The
ungovernable.
Yeah, it really is. And that, you know, I remember in 2016 when they were talking about election security, they're saying one of the blessings that makes it very hard for there to be a coherent physical attack, as opposed to, you know, spreading disinformation and hacking, whatever, is because it's so decentralized and states, so much power is given to the states. So it's this way by design, but it's doubly by design because you have, even though Trump himself doesn't really have any personal ideology, he is a Republican and he's a figurehead of a party that is defined by an idea that you want to get power as far away from Washington as possible, and to reduce the size of the federal government is an article of faith. So, I mean, again, this is by design. This is not some kind of aberration or hiccup. It's the way that they intend it to be, is for the federal government not to be the focal point. But you see what happens when there's a disaster that requires the federal government. I mean, you saw this under George W. Bush when Katrina hit. You saw the failures of FEMA and the federal government mobilizing, and you're seeing it again now in different ways.
A question for both of you on that. Do you learn something new about your own country when you look at this sort of by contrast? You're making some very interesting observations there, Jonathan, about the way the US works or sort of defiantly doesn't work. Does it sort of teach you new things, new perspective about how Australia does or can?
Well, I guess it has been heartening to watch Australia handle the COVID crisis certainly better than many other countries, and it's been was amazing to see Scott Morrison's performance change so drastically from his handling of the bushfires earlier this year. So that was very heartening. I mean, it's a reminder, I guess, that Australians basically like the state. We expect the state, and you know, it's completely different from the United States. Australians expect the government to be there to help them, And if, when it's not there, as it wasn't during the bushfires, they get very, very upset. Americans don't want the government to help them by and large. So there's a, the systems are so different that they're scarcely comparable. I mean, all we can say really is that Australia has done very well, with the exception of the way they handled that that cruise ship, letting the people in from that. If that hadn't happened, you know, the infection rate might be even lower than it is. It's already very, very low. But the other thing I'd just say about the states is that the federal government has been pretty disastrous, and the way in which Trump has tried to use the supply of medical equipment and so on during the crisis for political ends by sending, you know, masks and ventilators and what have you to Republican states, whether they wanted them or not, and depriving places like New York until Cuomo kicked up a huge fuss about it. I mean, that was pretty disgusting. But against that, you've seen some very interesting alliances of governors forming in this country. There's been the Northeastern alliance of governors over in this part of the world, where I think it's seven states led by Cuomo, including New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. And they're not all Republicans. It's a bipartisan alliance of states based on purchasing power and the ability to sort of work as a group economy. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not that continues to have any kind of traction after the virus, after this crisis has left us, if ever it does.
What about the impact on women, Anne? The downturn has exposed vulnerability and disadvantage of women in the workforce, gender segregation, many occupations, failure to properly value really what we all regard now as essential work, essential services. Are these strong elements of the debate in the US?
I don't think so. I'm not aware of it.
They're not really strong elements of the debate in Australia, at least not the gender aspect, but I wondered whether it was coming up.
I think that race is probably the predominant issue in American politics and American society. It dominates everything, and for very good reason, of course. We had a shocking murder of a man by the police just yesterday in Minnesota. So I think the impact of the coronavirus, well, first of all, it's had a greater impact on men than on women, which is something which is, I don't know if we really understand the reasons for that, but that's been fairly consistent, I think, across all age groups and all socioeconomic groups, that men are more susceptible to it than women. The one thing we have observed, of course, is that the majority of healthcare workers, particularly the nursing staff and hospital cleaning staff, are women, and so it has perhaps highlighted the essential nature of that work, which was underappreciated before, but whether or not we continue to value it and appreciate it after this current crisis, I wouldn't hold my breath. So I think the lessons from this, I guess we have to ask, will there be any long-term lessons learnt from this? And knowing America's track record on these things, I would say unlikely.
Mm. Is there the same debate, Jonathan, as is happening in Australia? And in this sense, it is quite a strong discussion point amongst governments and in the commentariat about economic and social reform, a kind of perestroika forced by the shutdown and the chance to rethink a number of the ways that we do things. So we see debates about industrial relations law, we see debates about taxation, education, division of responsibilities between the Commonwealth and the states. Is there that kind of macro debate environment in the US at the moment, or is it just too partisan?
Yeah, debate might be the wrong word for it. There's certainly a hunger, a very intense hunger on the left to not let the crisis go to waste and to use it as an opportunity to push for fundamental reforms that would be probably politically inconceivable in normal times. And I think there's probably been a false hope that's fostered on the left, because you are seeing these enormous packages get passed through Congress at light speed. The first one, $2.2 trillion. Then plus it up by $500 billion or whatever for the small businesses. But I think it's mistaken optimism, because Republicans are very united in not wanting there to be huge structural changes brought about as a result of COVID. So, yes, they were willing to green light cash payments, which don't make any structural change, right? Sending people checks for $1,200 doesn't fundamentally change anything. They're willing to even put in place a temporary boost to unemployment benefits. But I'll tell you what, that's an absolute red line for Republicans in the next bill. And so the extent to which Republicans want to push reforms in the next bill, it's reforms that will protect businesses. So one of their red lines is liability protection, just to make it much harder, if not impossible, for employees to sue their employers if they get sick after going back to work. So I don't see any space for the kind of radical, fundamental compromise that would be required. The only area I think that where something big could happen is infrastructure, and that's only because Trump himself is personally predisposed towards it. But even then, I'm very skeptical, because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is trying to pour cold water over the idea. So even a big boondoggle, expensive rebuild our bridges bill, which Trump would love to do, I just don't see that happening as long as Mitch McConnell's in charge of the Senate.
And just quickly from both of you on China, are we on the edge of a new Cold War in your estimation?
I can go first on that. Yes, in short. The China thing's really interesting, because Trump has a White House and an administration that is filled with China hawks, but he himself has always been quite ambivalent. So he has this long record of rhetorical bashing of China. That's all fine. We all know that. But since he's been president, he's actually been quite reluctant to go full Steve Bannon on China. And it's largely because he's wanted to keep this personal relationship with Xi Jinping, and he wanted to do trade deals and, you know, to some extent get along. But two things have happened recently. One is he always had his hawks, right, in the administration. So his National Security Council is dominated by China hawks. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is an ultra China hawk. His team is filled with China hawks. Peter Navarro, his trade advisor, ultra China hawk. But there's always been sort of moderating balance. His Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, and Larry Kudlow are much more moderate on China. But what's happened recently is his political team, and by that I mean his campaign manager, Brad Parscale, his pollster, John McLaughlin, they've become China hawks. Not because they've dived deep into the policy, but because they've looked at the polls. And what's happened is they have seized upon this as a really big campaign issue, and they see it as one of their key ways to hurt Joe Biden, to paint him as being weak on China. So you've had this merging of his political team with his national security team, and there's now no disagreement, really, that what you have to do is beat the hell out of China, whether he talks to his political advisors or his national security advisors. And so that, coupled with COVID and his real anger at what China did, and also his political opportunism at blaming somebody else, I think this is heading heading inevitably towards confrontation of different sorts. I don't know what exactly that's going to look like, but I think it's going to get worse and worse and worse this election season, and I actually don't know how to predict what's going to happen next. But I really, really don't see a way out of this clash right now. I think it's heading in a very, very dangerous direction.
Anne?
Well, there's not really a lot I can add to that, Mark, except to say it's going to be very interesting challenge for Australia.
Yes, that's very true indeed. It's been a problem for Australia right through, and of course the relationship between Beijing and Canberra probably hasn't been at a lower point in recent decades. So there's if there's still some way to go before we get to the bottom of it in terms of the cooling of the relationship, then you're right. It's going to be very difficult for Australia, particularly if our great ally, the US, is planning on ratcheting up the rhetoric even further. Look, it's been absolutely terrific. I expected this to be a brilliant conversation, and it's lived up to that. So thanks very much to Jonathan Swan and Dr. Anne Summers. It's been brilliant having you on board. Next week, we're going to take a closer look at a closer neighbour, that being Jacinda Ardern's New Zealand, which is also has an election on the horizon. And Ardern, of course, has been widely recognised around the globe for the very front-footed way that her government has responded to this crisis. We'll be taking a look at that. Thanks for joining us on Democracy Sausage, and see you again early next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.